of the things that's important for us in understanding our faith is that our faith and our lives are really based on a relationship with Jesus Christ. I know some people like to put that in contrast to religion. I don't think religion is a bad word at all to use about what we are. But they want to emphasize the relationship part, and I think that's good. It's kind of interesting, though. I mean, how do you have a relationship with a risen spirit? A little bit tricky at times to figure that out. Part of it is our relationship with other people here in this room, with the church, okay? Certainly that spiritual relationship is important for us to develop. And that's very much a part of who we are as human beings. I think we've tried to make that point over the last couple weeks, that we are spiritual beings. And we need that connection with that spirit realm. And that's a part of our relationship. In Matthew 10, I think Jesus expands on what that relationship is all about. He says some pretty difficult things here, but he also says some very encouraging things. And I think what Jesus is doing in this passage is injecting some reality into what our relationship with him is all about and how it's going to affect our lives. It may seem a little frightening, but at the same time, it's reality. It's a thing we have to face, and if we're going to deal with our relationship with him effectively and properly, we kind of need to know this stuff, okay? We need to face what he's talking about. And so one of the things we see, the first thing we see here is that humility comes first. A disciple is not above his teacher, okay? Jesus tells us that, and he wants us to know that, first of all, is the first foundation of the relationship. He's higher than we are, and we should, in fact, make sure that we understand that relationship is one of he's the teacher and master. We're just humble students and disciples and followers. And because of that relationship, we're going to endure some of the same things that he endured. We should not be surprised, perhaps, as Jesus is trying to tell us here, that people are going to malign us because we associate with something they don't like, namely Jesus and his teachings and the things he reveals about humanity and the things he challenges humanity with, the things he tells us that we are. And so it shouldn't surprise us that, as we learned this morning in Steve's class, when people say that Jesus was either out of his mind or he was demon-possessed, they're probably going to say something similar about us. There's something wrong with us. When in fact we know there's something very much right with us and what we're trying to do. Now, again, one of the things I want you to see here is that Jesus overcomes a lot of these difficulties with some assurances. And that's very much a part of the relationship. The first thing he says here is don't fear them. Verses 26 through 28. Do not be afraid. And, you know, the world can be intimidating to Christians. It seems it's getting more and more so over the last 10, 15, 20 years. Okay? People try to intimidate us. What Jesus says here is, first of all, don't be afraid of his words. Because at some point, he says, what I tell you in the dark, say in the light. What I proclaim to you in secret, shout from the rooftops. Okay? Don't be afraid, because everything that he says is going to be revealed. And maybe it's sort of a steady progression of being revealed. More and more people begin to hear about the truths of this faith and about the truths of what humanity really is. Also some truths about what good things are coming as a result of that. But there are there not, a lot of truths that humanity prefers to keep hidden. You know, we don't like to talk about our sins. We have a sort of do not ask, do not tell policy about, you know, what we are within ourselves. But we are told by Jesus, don't be embarrassed by his words. Face up to them. They are realities. God's truth is not going to come back to him without having its full effect. And I think that's one of the foundations upon which we build our relationship. We have to believe that God's word is both right and powerful, and that we have to be not afraid of it. The second thing he says is don't fear them. Don't fear those individuals. Don't fear those who can kill the body, but not kill the soul. Now, I don't know about you, but my first reaction to that is that's kind of ominous. There are those who can kill the body. By implication, perhaps, there are people who perhaps will attempt to kill the body. And if you've read anything at all, even though you don't hear a whole lot about it in a lot of the media, There's an awful lot of killing of Christians going on in other parts of the world, especially in Islamic countries. They are literally destroying them. They're kidnapping a lot of the women in Egypt. They're destroying churches, all in the name of Muhammad, all in the name of their prophet. They're killing Christians. They think Christians need to be wiped out. There are people who kill the body, and they have the power to do that. But what Jesus reminds us here is there's something better. There's something more powerful at work here. They cannot kill your soul. They can kill your body, but they cannot kill your soul. And so, you see, we perceive that this earthly existence is really just the beginning of eternity. And so when there are threats to our bodily, to our bodies, to our physical lives, even though I can't say I've ever been threatened by it, the point is, you know, don't be afraid of that. And I know that's easier said than done. Because when you're threatened with your life, it is frightening. And yet we're told, don't be afraid of that. Be afraid of the one who can kill not only your body, but your soul. Now, one of the things we perhaps have a little trouble getting at here is, he's referring to God there. God is the only one who can condemn our souls to eternity away from him. Satan does not have the power to do that. No other human being has the power to do that. Only God has the power to do that. So fear him. There is a healthy understanding of us in our relationship with God that, number one, as Jesus said, we're not above him. Number two, we need to have a very strong sense of respect to the point of maybe at times fear. We need to be afraid of him to the point where we realize, you know what? He has the power to do that. Nobody else does. Only God has the power to do that. So fear him. The people can hurt us temporarily. One writer said, God can harm us permanently. But you see, God doesn't want to harm us permanently. That's part of the key to all of this in that relationship. Because he goes on to talk about how much worth a Christian has. So, though he says, on the one hand, you know, fear God, on the other hand, he says, look at how much God really cares about you. God really doesn't want to condemn, but he has the power to do so. He knows, first of all, when a single sparrow falls to the ground, by implication, is a sparrow worth more than a human being? Well, perhaps people for the ethical treatment of animals, PETA, may say that. They may attempt to say that. Jesus does not say that. Jesus says, you are worth more than many sparrows. You're worth a lot. God knows even when a single sparrow falls to the ground. You know, sparrows, they look like they're kind of a dime a dozen type of birds. You know, they come in huge flocks, and hawks and falcons prey on them. And they die all the time. Jesus says, you're worth more than many of those. So don't be afraid. Trust that God is going to take care of you. The second thing he talks about is the hairs on your head. Has anybody ever tried to number the hairs on their head? I know for some of us, it's getting a little easier to do that because we have fewer and fewer of them. Amen. I wasn't thinking of anybody in particular, Floyd, okay? But, you know, maybe it's easier for God to keep track of us, Floyd, because we got fewer hairs. I mean, I don't know, okay? But just think about the number of hairs on your head. God knows them. I can't wrap my head around that amount of intelligence, that amount of knowledge. Thinking about just multiply that by the number of people in this room. And God says, I know the very hairs on your head. I got the number of every hair on your head. You know, that's beyond my comprehension. And yet that's the God that we serve. He knows us that intimately. In Psalm 139, verses 1 through 6, I think a fairly well-known psalm, he really expresses kind of the same thing, doesn't he? Listen to what he says. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Well, that's how I feel when every time Jesus talks about the very hairs on your head are numbered. Man, that's just beyond my comprehension. But that's the God that we serve. Be confident, Jesus says, of God's care for you. Don't be afraid. Then he goes on to say, after he says, don't fear them, he says, stand up for Christ. Acknowledge him. He says, acknowledge me and I'll acknowledge you. Isn't it interesting that Peter had the inability to do that very thing even after he'd spent 3 years with him? Now, we can point out Peter's mistake. I think Peter knew it well enough. But it really was a very grievous breach of the friendship and trust that they had developed over 3 years. Even if he wasn't the Son of God, it was a breach of trust that had built over quite a long time. Jesus said, deny me, well, I'll deny you. If you're gonna throw our relationship away that easily, don't expect Christ. Don't expect grace to overcome that. I'm sorry, but it's just the case. The relationship we have with Christ is a reciprocal one in some ways. Obviously, he gives more than we do. He gives grace. He gives forgiveness. But you have to be able to say, you know, denying Christ severs our connection with him. And we've done it intentionally when we do that. Part of the problem here is the world has so many intimidation tactics to get us to betray that relationship. And I think that's part of what makes it hard for us. I've got a bunch of them here that there's this, I had to throw a whole bunch of them out because I had so many illustrations of this very thing, of the intimidation tactics. The way the world tries to get us to either deny or even just maybe back away from our relationship. Maybe we don't turn our backs on him on purpose, we just sort of back away, you know, because we're afraid. And I think Jesus is just trying to say, look, do not do that. Don't be afraid of it. These things are important about what I'm all about. There's a couple of ways they do it. Number one is name-calling and mockery. One of the oldest and cheapest tricks in the books is to call people names and to make fun of them. I call it theology by sitcom. You know, you just sort of make fun of everything. And you build up certain, you build stereotypical characters and you make fun of them. You know, in some ways it's funny. In some situations maybe it's funny. But that's what people do with Christians. They build up these stereotypes that may have a small grain of truth to them and then they just make fun of it, destroy it, and just make it look stupid. Okay? The second thing that the world will do is they will apply peer pressure. I believe it was the CEO of Yahoo who was forced to resign because he had given money to support the marriage amendment in California. He donated like $1,000. And somehow some people got word of it and they forced him out because he had simply done that. Peer pressure. And how about intolerance and lies? Are you aware of the truth about the St. Patrick's Day parade? Now, I know what you heard was that, you know, the gays were not allowed to march in that parade. Well, actually, they were. Some people may not realize that. They were allowed to march. What they were not allowed to do was to carry a banner proclaiming who they were. Okay? And that's what they insisted they be allowed to do that. And that was not the rules of the parade. That's the way the parade was set up. Very interesting. I believe his name was Bill O'Donnell. He's the leader of some Catholic league in New York. He said to those who were organizing the gay parade later, he says, well, we want to march in your parade and we want to hold banners that said straight and proud of it. Anybody guess what they said? No, you're not going to march because you want to carry banners. Okay, so there was it just wasn't right. You know, it just wasn't right the way that whole thing went off. You may have seen headline recently. Republican congressman says women, quote, desperately looking for a husband. Okay, now, you know, just reading that headline, what does it sound like? it sounds like, well, you know, they're just saying women are just, you know, they're just, they can't stand on their own. You know, they just want to have a husband. That's what Republicans think of women. Well, listen to the context of where that particular quote came from, and you tell me if that's what he was saying. Tim Hulskamp, I think he's a congressman from Oklahoma, I think, but I'm not sure, from the Midwest somewhere. Anyway, he was giving a speech, and he said this: "I want to close with this, with a message to every man in America, every man in this crowd, every husband in America. Your children need you. Your woman, your wife, she needs you. It's time that you became a real man and stand up for those who need you. Love your family, love your wife, love your children because they desperately need you. They're desperately looking for a husband. They're desperately looking for a father. Be a real man of God because this is about you. Marriage is about you and your wife and your children." So it's very easy to spread a lie simply by taking something out of context and giving people a sort of impression that this is what you said. But in context, maybe that's not really what you said or what you meant. And that's how it often is done. You know, take things out of context. Don't people do that with the Bible? You know, they say, well, don't judge because, you know, you're not, you know, don't judge because you'll be judged. Or they pick on something that Jesus says, like, you know, if your eye offends you, pluck it out. You know, and any reasonable person reading the Bible knows that in context, Jesus was using simply a figure of speech to emphasize how serious sin is. No, he's not ever telling anybody to go and disfigure yourself. Nobody, it may have been a few isolated incidents of that throughout Christian history, but everybody knows that's not what he was talking about. It's taken out of context. The last thing that people will do is they will blame you for their sins. Now, you may have heard terrorists do this, and they do this all the time. They will take hostages, and they'll say, we're going to kill the hostages. And if you don't give in to our demands, it's your fault they're going to die. I mean, talk about turning tables on you, and talk about, you know, pulling at your guilt strings as if somehow it's your fault that they kill the person. But that's what they do. That's what people often do. And I was reading just this past week that in Egypt, the Muslims were sexually harassing, and worse, women when Mohamed Morsi was president. And they were told, the women were told by the people harassing them, well, it's your fault because you're supporting, you know, other than the Muslim Brotherhood. They're blaming the women. They were mistreating the women and then blaming the women because they were supporting somebody else. And I just, you know, you kind of go away shaking your head. How can they possibly turn the tables on people in that way? It just doesn't, you know, it's bizarre, is really what it is. It's bizarre. But that's what people do. And they will do that to Christians as well. So, you know, there are just a number of ways that we can be intimidated, and some of it's pretty serious here. Some of it's pretty challenging, but you know, that's kind of part of what our faith is. It's just, unfortunately, the reality of what this world is all about. And that brings us really to the last point I think Jesus is making here. And that is that Christianity does, in fact, create conflict. You know, we always say our religion is one of peace, and that is true. And yet peace comes, first of all, by sort of going through the conflict of seeing who we are. Okay? And when Jesus says, don't think that I have come to bring peace to the earth, I have come not to bring peace but a sword, he's really trying to tell us that the words that he has to say are going to stir things up. And they're going to create some conflict in the world. They create conflict because Jesus has come telling people the truth about who we are and about righteousness and about true justice. And so he's not simply trying to say, all right, I'm just going to come and I'm trying to kill people. That's not it at all. He knows that his words are going to create some conflict. We have to ask ourselves, should Christians be silent about all the lies and injustices that occur in this world? Christianity stands directly in the path of these things. In fact, in the path of all unrighteousness. You know, we believe that for our own sins. You know, Jesus has confronted us in our own sins. And it hasn't always been pleasant for us to face up to them. It creates a conflict within each individual, does it not? Because the gospel goes straight through every human heart. That's where it works, and that's where it has its most powerful effect. And that's where often the conflict occurs and comes from. Should we be surprised that conflict results when the truth is pointed out to us? Revelation chapter 19, 15 presents a very interesting image, in my estimation. Near the end of the chapter of Revelation, the writer is trying to assure his audience that God is in charge and that God's going to win. And he has this picture of a rider on a white horse with his legions of soldiers behind him. You know, shades of the cavalry, I suppose, coming in to save the day. But the image of the rider on the right white horse is an interesting one. It says, from his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. Think about the image. A sharp sword from his mouth to strike down the nations. Might that not be referring to Jesus' words and how powerful his words are when the nations have to confront the truth about ourselves, about who Jesus is, and about a lot of things about the world in which we live? And I think this is illustrated most dramatically by what Jesus says next about our family relationships. Jesus is not saying he wants to create division in the family. I think what he's saying here is when family relationships are threatened, as they are by the gospel, it indicates that something really is wrong with the world. There's something really rotten in Denmark. We don't blame God for that. We blame humanity for that, for who we are, for what we say, for what we think, for how we are not in good relationship with God. Let me conclude with just a couple of things here. I know some of this has been very challenging, but I think it is directly connected with our relationship with God and understanding just who he is. Jesus reminds us here that, number one, our relationship with him leads to the cross, verse 38. Leads to our dying on the cross. It leads to a challenge to others for them also to die on the cross. He says, we only gain our lives when we lose them. One of those great paradoxes of the Christian faith. When we lose ourselves for Christ's sake, that's when we really gain life. The transformation of our behavior is affected by him and in this life. I think that's a critical factor in our relationship with him. What we gain, however, is greater than anything the world can offer. And admittedly, that puts our thoughts in the next world. We have to keep our feet in this one, but it's not such a bad thing to think about the next world and realize that there is a crown of life waiting for us. As Paul said, it was waiting for him. And so Jesus reminds his disciples here, do not be afraid. Fear God and keep his commandments. Acknowledge him and his words. And we end simply by reminding ourselves, stand with Christ as you would with any good friend in whose relationship you have built trust. Lloyd, let's stand and sing.